I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being's Unheard Cuts. You're listening to my unedited conversation with Alain de Botton. Listen to our produced show with him wherever you find your podcasts, and as always, at onbeing.org. Hello.
Hi, Krista. What a pleasure and an honor.
You too. It's great to speak with you again. I don't know if you remember our conversation.
Of course. It was a landmark in my life.
Oh, well, excellent. I'm glad to hear that.
Of course.
Yeah, I'm very happy to have you at the other end of the conversation again.
I'm so pleased. So pleased.
And I've loved following what you're doing with the School of Life. I'm actually speaking at the School of Life in Australia this summer.
Are you? Great.
And
oh, that's
wonderful. I feel like it's making such a mark, and I'm really grateful, actually, for what you're doing.
Oh, that's so nice. Thank you. And these are troubled days in your republic.
Indeed they are. And in yours as well.
Well, yes, I know, but you make us now look like a sideshow.
I know.
You've beaten us to it.
Let's start talking on the air, because I'm afraid we might venture into some territory that we want to capture.
Maybe we shouldn't. But anyway, I'm ready when you are.
Okay. All right. No, I don't think it's completely unrelated to what we're speaking about today.
Okay.
In terms of human dynamics, purely human dynamics under the surface, which turn up on the political surface looking like pretending to be something else.
Yes, that's very interesting. Is this going out soon or in a long time?
Actually, this one we are planning to turn around pretty quickly. I'm just looking behind the glass. I think we're doing it for Valentine's Day. Right?
Oh, my goodness. That makes sense.
Okay. Yeah, so very soon.
Okay. Right. Okay.
Yeah. So we're excited.
Okay, good. No, it just also gives me a sense of, you know, how topical or not to be in that.
Yeah, well, you know, we try to do everything
for eternity.
We try to step back from is just merely momentary. Anyway, let's have a big conversation.
Yeah.
And, you know, don't worry too much one way. Although these things, you know, these.
The crises in our republic are
going to be with us for a while too.
Yeah, well, that's true. But people get fed up, and it's good to give them something else.
Exactly. Well, yes. Yeah. Well, what happened?
And that's what you do so well.
Well, thank you. I mean, what happened 20 minutes ago is going to be covered in a million ways, and people want. I mean, that's what you're working at too, kind of elevating.
Exactly.
And also deepening. Okay, so Chris, are we good? All right, great. Then let's just dig in. So we did speak a few years ago, but on a very different topic, and I'm excited to be speaking with you about this subject, which is so close to every life. And as I've prepared for this, I realized that you've actually, I mean, I knew that you'd written the novel on love a long time ago, but you've really been consistently attending to this subject and building your thoughts on it and your body of work on it, which is really interesting to me. I mean, you wrote On Love at the age of 23, which is so young, and you were already thinking about this so deeply. I mean, I think this is the first line. Every fall into love involves the triumph of hope over knowledge. So I'm just kind of curious as we start about, I always start my conversations, whatever we're talking about the background of someone's childhood. And I know, you know, you have spoken and written about your childhood as one that had a emotional deprivation, and there was a lot of trauma, actually, and even exile in your parents' lives. But how do you, you know, what would you say about in the background of your life, you know, what you learned and internalized about love and marriage, which made this at such a young age such a deep subject for you?
Well, I think that one of the things that parents, nice parents, try to keep from their children is that life is in many ways bleak, lonely, and brief. And I think these are the sort of horrific truths that children are shielded from. What we call a difficult childhood is, I think, one in which, for whatever reason, some of these adult insights come a little bit too early, perhaps when one's not ready. And I think that anyone who's had that sort of a childhood will react to it in some way. There will be an element of needing to you know, go back and redeem something, atone for something, right. Patch something up. And for me, you know, I became a writer, I think, in order to try and understand emotional life in a way that when I was a child, you know, emotions really perturbed me. And I think that, you know, when people say, you know, why did you become a writer, an intellectual, etc., you know, I can almost just have a very basic answer, which is it was a way of coping. I'm one of those people. And, you know, there are many of us out there who...
Yes, and I'm one of them too.
Right. Well, you know, when something goes wrong, what's the first thing they want to do? They want to be alone, probably with some paper and a pen, and write stuff down. And they may not even want to have, you know, any aspirations to publish or anything. It's just the most soothing, calming, redeeming thing you can do. And that, for me, was the origin of writing. Long before there were was such a thing as a book or a publisher, there was the need to write because writing was consoling, calming. By interpreting emotions, I got a handle on them, and they seemed less threatening, less alienating, less hurtful.
Yes, and I think, you know, there are also many, 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 many of us, which actually is a logical implication of the way you write about the reality of love, who had those difficult, painful, who had confusing and troubling experiences, first experiences of what love and marriage mean. And yet somehow, and I think this gets at the larger context and point of the work you've done on this, the thinking you've done on it, it continues to fly in the face so that we almost kind of negate it and treat it as abnormal in the face of this, the way we do love now as a feeling and as an ideal.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, what's striking is that our idea of what love is, our idea of what is normal in love is so not normal.
It's so abnormal,
and
right.
So abnormal. And so we castigate ourselves for not having a normal love life,
right.
Even though no one seems to have any of these.
Or you know, been loved perfectly.
Right. So we have this ideal of what love is, and then these very, very unhelpful narratives of love. And they're in everywhere. You know, they're in movies and songs. And we mustn't blame songs and movies too much. But we have a socialized account of what a relationship might be like, which is simply hugely at variance from most people's experience. So most people experience themselves as, in one way or another, freakish. In some way or other, they feel, what's wrong with me? My love story is supposed to be like this. In fact, it's like that.
Right.
And I think that art, culture, has an enormous role to play in nuancing the stories that we tell ourselves about who we are and introducing complexity and ultimately compassion into these stories. Because let's not forget that a caricatured story is, at the end of the day, an ungenerous story, a story that's lacking in compassion. You know, if you say, you know, they met, they were happy, and, you know, they lived their whole life in bliss, and that seemed to be the normal narrative of when Jack meets Jill, you know, that's going to be strangely quite a punitive story. If you say to people, look, love is a painful, poignant, touching attempt by two flawed individuals to try and meet each other's needs in situations of gross uncertainty and ignorance about who they are and who the other person is, but, you know, we're going to do our best. That's a much more generous starting point. So the acceptance of ourselves as flawed creatures seems to me what love really is. You know, it's interesting because I think we're wrestling in our culture with two contrasting ideas of what love is. The first view is that love is an emotion that is generated by perfection, by something that's amazing, by a very beautiful person, an exciting person, an intelligent person. And then there's another view that love is really the emotion that you bring to bear on what is flawed and what is imperfect, that you know, love is at its most necessary when we are weak, when we feel incomplete, and we must show love to one another at those points. So we've got these two contrasting stories, and we get them muddled.
You know, I feel like this should be obvious, but you just touched on art and culture and how that could help us complexify our understanding of this. But you also write about, and I think a lot about, how we internalize so many of our images of how a romance should develop and what it is to fall in love from, understandably, we internalize images from movies and wonderful TV shows and beautiful love songs. And one of the things you point out, about When Harry Met Sally or Four Weddings and a Funeral, one of the things that's wrong with all of that is that a lot of these take us up to the wedding. They take us through the falling, and don't see that. I think you've written somewhere, you said a wiser culture than ours would recognize that the start of a relationship is not the high point that romantic art assumes. It is merely the first step of a far longer, more ambivalent and yet quietly audacious journey on which we should direct our intelligence and scrutiny.
That's right. I mean, we are strangely obsessed by the run-up to love. And what we call a love story is really just the beginning of love story, but we leave that out. Mm-hmm. And so, but, you know, most of us, we're interested in long-term relationships. We're not just interested in the moment that gets us into love. We're interested in the survival of love over
time. That's what we're longing for. Yeah.
That's what we're longing for. Yeah. And yet, of course, that is the very tricky bit that gets very left out of art. I mean, you can count on one hand how many movies every decade dealing with the non-dramatic. And let's face it, often it is non-dramatic. It may be full of silent humiliation and pain, but it's broadly speaking non-dramatic. Movies and stories that latch onto those bits of life are very few and far between. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to give you one example, I don't know if you saw Richard Linklater's Before Midnight, but that for me is recent examples of a really great movie that looks at what happens to a couple long term. And it's not without tenderness and love, but it's also full of, well, just, you know, it's human, all too human. It's at times pretty frightening. But we need to see representations of this, because all of us know our own lives from the inside, but we know other people's lives only from what they choose to tell us. And generally, because they want to seem normal, they don't tell us very much. And so we end up feeling very isolated.
Right.
I think one of the key jobs of culture is to de-isolate us and to give us evidence of what life is like for other people so that we can feel normal.
You know, and you're right that, that's one way to maybe understand why cinematic storytelling often, it's hard to do this because it doesn't have a kind of dramatic external narrative arc. It's a lot of what you are pointing at, the work of loving over a long span of time, is inner work, right? and it'd be hard to film that. But, you know, I'm very intrigued by how you talk about the ancient Greeks and their pedagogical view of love.
Yes, that, right? I mean, that's fascinating because one of the greatest insults that you can level at a lover in the modern world, apparently, is to say, I want to change you. And one of the most, you know, offended moments in relationships are when somebody says, are you trying to change me? And this is seen as absolutely the enemy of love. It's like, my goodness, I thought you loved me, but now I've realized you're trying to change me. So that means you don't love me. And this, look, it sounds very normal in our own time. It would have sounded extremely unusual to the ancient Greeks. The ancient Greeks had a view of love which was essentially based around education. That what love means, love is a benevolent process whereby two people try to teach each other how to become the best versions of themselves.
Now, you say somewhere they are committed to increasing the admirable characteristics
that
that they possess and the other person possesses.
And that what love is...
Which is a twist on changing you. I mean, it is...
absolutely. And so the Greek view is you fall in love with the perfect things in another person, with the accomplished, beautiful things. But then the work of love is to try and make more and more of a person accomplished, perfect, virtuous. Mm-hmm. That's what love aims at. So love explicitly aims at change. Now, you know, many relationships and their troubles could be analyzed as attempts by both people to teach one another things, but failing to do so miserably. So many, many what we call arguments are really lessons that have gone terribly wrong. And they go wrong really for two reasons. Firstly, because the so-called, in inverted commas, teacher, the person in the teaching role, is so panicked, so anxious. And they're anxious because at the back of their minds they think, I mean, the haunting thought that makes people lose their tempers in relationship is basically the fear that they've married an idiot, that they've ruined their life by being in the presence of someone who just refuses to understand. So they lose their temper.
And also
so they try
just those terrifying moments when you start to understand. I mean, what was that line from On Love? Every fall into love imbibes the false triumph of hope over knowledge. And as the knowledge becomes more front and center, that kind of... You're right. The deterioration of that ideal can be terrifying.
That's right. Yeah. And so people are trying to teach one another things, but with impatience, with anger, with a sense of bitterness, and meanwhile,
with fear they can't even own up to. Probably.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. And so they're terrible ambassadors for their feeling. They're making a mess of it. Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, the person on the other side, in the so-called pupil role, in the student role, is beset by this idea that it's an insult. The whole game is an insult because it involves an attempt to change. So both people are incredibly twitchy and angry and tense about the whole situation, and the lesson goes nowhere, and what you end up with is bitterness on both sides. Yeah. You get the person who, rather than attempting to teach gently, just attempts to impose their will in a kind of managerial and strict way, and the other person just runs away and shirks and just doesn't want to listen and just shuts their ears. So that's what relationships so often end up as, failed teaching moments.
There's your most recent book on this subject is The Course of Love, which is a novel. But it's a novel that actually I feel you kind of weave a pedagogical narrator voice into it. Do you think that's fair?
That's right. Absolutely.
Woven into the narrative. And this is an example of what you're describing. And you say at one point this is the relationship between Robbie and Kirsten and you said at one point, their relationship is secretly yet mutually marked by a project of improvement, which I think we all recognize. So, in fact, we do have this pedagogical instinct, but we don't think we're supposed to, as you say. And then there's this moment where you say, after the dinner party, Robbie is sincerely trying to bring about an evolution in the personality of the wife he loves. But his chosen technique is distinctive: to call Kirsten materialistic, to shout at her, and then later to slam two doors.
That's right. And of course, by the time
we all recognize that scene.
By the time we've humiliated someone, they're not going to learn anything. The only conditions, as we know with children, the only conditions under which anyone learns are conditions of incredible sweetness, tenderness, patience. That's how we learn. But the problem is that, the failures of our relationships have made us so anxious that we can't be the teachers we should be. And therefore, some often, genuine, legitimate things that we want to get across are just, come across as insults, as attempts to wound, and are therefore rejected, and the arteries of the relationship start to fur.
Yeah. Someone recently said to me, I'm curious about how you respond to this. It was a wise Jewish mother who had said to them, men marry women with the intention that they, with the idea that they will stay the same. Women marry men with the idea that they will change. Which is obviously a huge generalization, but it made a lot of sense to me, even in terms of my own life and in terms of what I see around me.
Yeah, I mean, I would argue that both genders want to change one another, and they both have an idea of who the lover should be.
Yeah. Right.
And I think, a useful exercise that sometimes psychologists, level at feuding couples is they say things like, if you could accept that your partner would never change, how would you feel about that? And the idea is to bring about a kind of forgiveness, because so often what gets us both, feeling desperate but also excited about change is the sense it could be different. Sometimes pessimism, a certain degree of pessimism, can be a friend of love.
Yeah.
Once we accept that actually it's really very hard for people to be another way, we're sometimes readier. We don't need people to be perfect is the good news. We just need people to be able to explain their imperfections to us in good time before they've hurt us too much with them and with a certain degree of humility. That's already an enormous step.
It's a lot to ask, but it sounds reasonable, right? I mean, if we could really have that in our minds early enough on in a relationship.
That's right. And you know, almost from the first date, you know, my view of what one should talk about on a first date is not showing off or not, you know, putting forward one's accomplishments, but almost quite the opposite. You know, one should say, well, how are you crazy? I'm crazy like this.
Right.
You know, and there should be a mutual acceptance that two damaged people are trying to get together, because pretty much all of us, there are a few totally healthy people, but pretty much all of us reach dating age with, you know, some scars, some wounds. Mm-hmm. And of course, the more we know about them and the more we're able to introduce the topic in a kind of non-pejorative, non-agitated way, the more success we'll have. But we're operating, you know, it's not a coincidence that people in the early days of love call each other angel. You know, we've got this sort of deity, this sort of secularized deity, who is our lover, who then turns out, you know, not to be such a thing. And we rage and rant. I mean, look, a lot of this comes from ideas that we have in childhood. When we're children, our parents can sometimes seem like supernatural creatures. They have powers way beyond anything we have. They know all sorts of things, etc. And sometimes we bring to adult relationships some of the same hope that a young child might have had of their parent. And of course, an adult relationship can't be like that. It's got to accept that the person across the table or on the other side of the bed is just human, which means full of flaws, fears, right, etc., and not some sort of superhuman.
Yeah, and I think that question that you said could be a standard question on an early date, and how are you crazy? There's also something that you're getting at that it almost seems like we must be hardwired to do this. Although, you know, one of the wonderful things we're learning in the 21st century is that we can change our brains. But the way you say it in On Love, in a scene in On Love, is, oh, actually, let me just look at it. You know, that boy meets girl, and you start to be enamored in details of this new person and find things in common. Like, I don't know, both of us had two large freckles on the toe of the left foot. And then he wrote, you know, instinctively, and this happens very quickly, he teases out an entire personality from the details. But also, I what I know from my own life is you tend to, and I think when we fall in love with another person, we magnify in our minds those things that are immediately enrapturing, and craft our idea of the other person almost exclusively around those wonderful qualities, which is not fair to them or to us.
That's right. And we feel in a way that we know them already, and we impose on them an idea.
Of course we don't. Right.
And we don't.
Right.
We don't. Which, right, you know, also explains another phenomenon that I'm fascinated by, and you probably would have noticed in both novels, is the phenomenon of being in a sulk, of sulking. Because sulking is a fascinating situation which takes you right into the heart of certain romantic delusions. Because what's fascinating about sulking is that we don't sulk with everybody. We only get into sulks with people that we feel should understand us, but rather unforgivably haven't understood us. So in other words, it's when we are in love with people and they're in love with us that we take particular offense when they get things wrong. Because the kind of the governing assumption of the relationship is this person should know what's in my mind, ideally without me needing to tell them. If I need to spell this out to you, you don't love me. And that's why, you know, you'll go into the bathroom, bolt the door, and when your partner says, you know, is anything wrong, you'll go, mm-mm. And the reason is that they should be able to read through the bathroom panel into your soul and know what's wrong. And that's such an extraordinary demand. And
so,
you know,
we
see it in children. I mean, this is how little children behave. They literally think that their parents can read their minds. It takes a long time to realize that the only way that one person can really learn about another is if it's explained to them, preferably using words, quite calm
use
ones.
Your words.
But you know, when people always say communicate, I mean, you know, we have to be generous towards the reasons why we don't, and we don't because we're operating with this mad idea that true love means intuitive understanding. And you know, I go crazy when people say things like, "I met someone. You know, the loveliest thing is they understood me without me needing to speak." You know, and I thought so many alarm bells go off when I hear that, because I think, okay, well, good luck for you know, good luck in this instance. But you know, if you guys get together, that's not going to go on forever. No one can, you know, intuitively understand another beyond a quite limited range of topics.
Right. Your children, how old are your children? They're still pretty young, right?
Yeah, they're 10 and 12 now.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so I, you know, as the now that I have young adult children, it's, you know, you when you hear that coming out of the mouth of your 21-year-old, you know, he should know.
Right.
He should just know.
Right.
And you just but what I also know is that grasping this, what you're talking about is it is the work of life, right?
It's the work of love. And, you know, but it's interesting that you know, you're mentioning your children and children generally, because I think there is, it sounds eerie, but I think that one of the kindest things that we can do with our lover is to see them as children. And not to infantilize them, but when we're dealing with children as parents, as adults, we're incredibly generous in the way we interpret their behavior. And if a child says, if you walk home and a child says, "I hate you," right, you immediately go, okay, that's not quite true. Probably they're tired,
right,
they're hungry, something's
right,
gone wrong, someone, their tooth hurts, something. We're looking around for a benevolent interpretation that can just shave off some of the more, you know, depressing, dispiriting aspects of their behavior. Mm. And we do this naturally with children, and yet we do it so seldom with adults. You know, when an adult meets an adult and they say, you know, I don't know, I've not had a good day, leave me alone. Rather than saying, okay, I'm just going to go behind the facade of this slightly depressing
and
comment,
understand that that's actually not about me, that's about what's going on
right,
inside them today.
Right, exactly. We don't do that. We take it all completely personally. And so I think, you know, the work of love is to try, when we can manage it, we can't always, to go behind the front of this rather, you know, depressing, challenging behavior and try and ask where it might have come from. I mean, this is, you know, this is traditionally in Christianity, this is what, you know, God does. God looks behind the dispiriting surface of someone. You know, someone is an alcoholic, a prostitute, etc., and ordinary people shun them. But, you know, God's love looks behind the scenes. And we find this in literature, too. Think of Dostoevsky's characters. You know, they are often very damaged people, gamblers, alcoholics, murderers. You know, but the skill and the love of the novelist is to take you behind and show you what lies behind that behavior. And look, we can't do it every day, but at least to know that that is an important part of what love is, what love should be. Love is doing that work to ask oneself, where's this come from? Where's this rather aggressive, pained, non-communicative, unpleasant behavior come from? If we can do that, we're on the road to knowing a little bit about what love really is, I think.
Hmm. You know, I'd love to talk about you used this word pessimism a little while ago, and I'd love to dig into that a little bit more. And what you're really talking about is being reality based, as opposed to being ideal based. There's a beautiful video that I've shared that's out there called I think it's The Darkest Truth About Love. Is that right? That's the title.
Yes, that's right. Exactly.
Yes,
made that for YouTube.
I'd like to talk through, you know, some of these core truths that fly in the face of this way we go around behaving and that movies have taught us to behave and that possibly our parents taught us to behave.
Yes.
These core truths that can put us on the foundation of reality.
Yes. I mean, that's very useful. We could chisel them in granite. I mean, look, one of the first important truths is, you're crazy. Not you, as it were, all of us. That all of us are deeply damaged people.
Right.
The great enemy of love, good relationships, good friendships is self-righteousness. And self-righteousness is rooted in a sense of our own purity. If we start by accepting that, of course, we're, you know, only just holding it together and in many ways really quite challenging people. You know, I think if somebody thinks that they're easy to live with, they're by definition going to be pretty hard and don't have much of an understanding of themselves. I think, you know, there's a certain wisdom that begins by knowing that, of course, you, like everyone else, is pretty difficult. And of course, this knowledge is very shielded from us. You know, our parents don't tell us, our ex-lovers, they knew it, but they couldn't be bothered to tell us. They, you know, sacked us without.
Well, by the time they tell us, we're dismissing what they say anyway.
Well, that's right. That's right. Exactly. Or they were too sweet. You know, they didn't want to reform us. They were just wanted to get out. So they didn't tell us. And our friends don't tell us because they just want a pleasant evening with us. So we're left with a sort of bubble of ignorance about our own natures. And often, you know, you can be way into your 40s before you're starting to get a sense of, oh, well, maybe some of the problem is in me. Because, of course, you know, it's so intuitive to think that, of course, it's the other person. So to begin with that sense of, you know, for whatever reason, things to do with childhood and development, etc., I'm quite tricky in these ways. That's a very important starting point for being good at love. Mm. The other thing, of course, is to realize that anyone that we could get together with is also going to be deeply flawed, that there is no such thing as a perfect person. And I think the essence of romantic longing is this belief that someone out there, maybe you saw them at the airport check-in line, maybe you crossed them in the supermarket, maybe you saw them when you were swiping left or right on the app, but that somewhere out there, there is this extraordinary creature called the right person, and that the right person is going to be someone who understands you, who's on your side, who is extremely benevolent towards everything that you are and feel and want, and that they're out there, and that, you know, so often we blame our lovers, we don't blame our view of love, and so we keep sacking our lovers and blowing up relationships in pursuit of this idea of love, which actually has no basis in reality. It's simply not rooted in anything we know.
I mean, this right person, this creature, does not exist,
and is in fact the enemy of good enough relationships. You know, I'm really fond of Donald Winnicott, this English psychoanalyst's term, which he first used in relation to parenting, that, you know, what we should be aiming for is not perfection, but a good enough situation. Mm-hmm. And it's wonderfully downbeat. You know, no one would go, you know, what are your hopes this year? Well, I just want to have a good enough relationship. People would go, oh, I'm sorry your life's so grim. But you want to go, no, that's really good. That's kind of, for a human, that's brilliant. Yeah. And that's I think, the attitude we should have.
Yeah. One of the, at this darkest truth about love, you know, you say the idea of love, in fact, distracts us from existential loneliness. You are irredeemably alone. You will not be understood. But also behind that is these are dark truths, but it's also a relief because as truth always ultimately is, if we can hear it, that again, that is the work of life.
Yes, that's right. I mean, you know,
what goes on inside us.
I think one of the greatest sorrows we sometimes have in love is the feeling that our lover doesn't understand parts of us. Mm-hmm. And to this sorrow, and it is a sorrow, let's not make any bones about it, to this sorrow we add another layer of sorrow, which is the feeling that this sorrow is unnecessary. And so we say, you know, they don't understand my taste in movies. Or there's a moment when I'm chatting to my mother and they don't understand how I feel. Or they don't understand some of my aspirations about work, etc. And we blame them. And we see, and of course, there are always going to be people who do understand those sides of us. But there is no one who can understand every side of us and feel in total congruity with our own feelings. And so, you know, At many points in life, we're simply not going to be understood. And a certain kind of bravery, a certain heroic acceptance of loneliness seems to be one of the key ingredients to being able to form a good relationship. That if you expect that your lover must understand.
Yeah.
Of course. If you expect that your lover must understand everything about you, you'll be furious pretty much all the time. Mm-hmm. There are islands and moments of beautiful connection. But we have to be modest about how often they're going to happen. I think, you know, if you're lonely with only, 40% of your life, that's really good going. You may not want to, be lonely with over 50%, but, I think, there's certainly a sizable minority share of your life, which you're going to have to endure without echo from those you love.
Yeah. You know, I debated over whether I would discuss this with you, but I think I will. Like, I'm single right now and have been for a few years, and it's actually been a great joy. Not that I think I will be single forever or want to be single forever. Although actually, I think I would be all right if I were. You know, which is a real watershed. And I'm, you know, and also what this part of this chapter of life has taught me to really enjoy more deeply and take more seriously all the many forms of love in life, aside from just, you know, the romantic love or being coupled.
Well, it's funny because, you know, just as you were saying,
yeah,
I mean, just as you were saying, I'm single. I was about to say you're not, because
no,
you know, we have
right.
to look at what this idea of singlehood is. I mean, we've got this word single, which captures somebody who's
but
not
so
you know, got a long term relationship. That's right.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
and you know, another way of looking at love is connection. We're all the time, you know, we are hardwired to seek connections with others. And that is, in a sense, at a kind of granular level, what love is. Love is connection.
Yeah.
And we can connect in all sorts of ways that go far beyond, you know, the understanding of a relationship. So you can connect with a book, with a long dead person, with an idea. These are all forms of connection. And insofar as one is alive and one is in buoyant, relatively buoyant spirit some of the time, it's because we are connected. And, you know, we can take pride in how flexible our minds ultimately are about where that connection is coming. We don't necessarily need a relationship. And I think it's also worth saying that, you know, for some people, relationships are not necessarily the place where they encounter their best selves. That actually, you know, the person that they are in a relationship is not the person that they want to be, or that they can be in other areas of life, that they feel that there are other possibilities that they'd like to explore.
Mm-hmm.
And, I think getting into a relationship with someone, asking someone to be with you is a pretty cruel thing to do to someone that you love and admire and respect, because the job is so hard. Most people fail at it. You know, when you ask someone to marry you, for example, you're asking someone to, you know, be your chauffeur, co-host, sexual partner, co-parent, fellow accountant, you know, mop the kitchen floor together, etc., etc. And on the list goes. No wonder that we fail at some of the tasks and get irate with one another. It's a burden. And I think sometimes, you know, the older I get, sometimes I think one of the nicest things you can do to someone that you really admire is leave them alone. Just let them go. Let them be. You know, don't impose yourself on them because you're challenging.
I'm glad we walked into this territory because it everything you're writing and thinking about love is really about the human enterprise, right? And it's really about growing up as a human being. Or aspiring to do that through the course of one's life. And so, and what that means, you know, one of the things that means is that this conversation is open to people wherever they are in terms of what their love life is, right? I mean, that this is a path we're all on. And
that's right.
And I think, many forms of love and growing up in our lives.
That's right. And, you know, I think growing up, I mean, look, let's be honest here. Growing up sounds horrible. It sounds really dull. One of the most awful words in the language is maturity. That sounds horrible. I mean, one of my incidental goals is to try and slightly rehabilitate and lend new prestige to maturity. Because I think one of the things that we must all strive for is to try and be mature. We'll never quite get there, but it's a wonderful goal. And of course, when it comes to emotional life, we're given so little encouragement to try and get there. You know, we insist on finding. This is something that the new novel, The Course of Love, is really all about this. It's about two people who realize ultimately that love is not just a feeling, an emotion, an intensity of heart. It's actually a skill. And it's a skill that, and this sounds very odd, that can be learned. And it sounds bizarre. I mean, the idea of having to go to school to learn love, it just, you know, everything about us, and we live in a romantic age, an age that believes in the reign of feeling. I mean, we believe in training to become a pilot or a brain surgeon, but if someone said, I'm going to train to be a better lover, I mean, you think it was eerie. And yet, of course, that is precisely the sort of training we need. And oddly, and it sounds, well, as we put it, so unromantic, but there are things we know about why couples break up, about what can help a relationship, etc. These things are not mysterious. You know, for example, one of the key things that we learn
we should apply intelligence to this aspect of our life. Which
exactly.
Is so
exactly.
Central, we apply intelligence to our other disciplines and our other experiences.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, one of the basic things that you learn is that when somebody says, "I've gone off my lover," let's say a relationship has cooled sexually, we're taught by our culture to think, well, that's just the waning of passion. It's just one of those mysterious things. It's like the sort of removal of some divine force, and there's not much to do other than, you know, watch TV, and there's nothing much you can do. And of course, what immediately happens if you talk to a psychologist around this is that they will tend to say that the decline in desire has its roots in anger. That almost certainly the person that you no longer desire, you're angry with them. Now, why are you angry with them? Because they've let you down. And they've let you down in ways that you haven't been able necessarily to even acknowledge yourself, let alone convey to them in a form that they can understand. And therefore, the channels of feeling have become dammed. And without understanding quite why, the thought of them touching you has become repulsive. And you just want to read a book. And, you know, to know, you know, that the skill of knowing, okay, maybe it's not that you've lost feeling. Maybe it's you're furious, but you've slightly forgotten why. Because you were injured not by a large thing, but by a small thing. Because when we're in love, we're all quite defenseless. And so we get hurt by very minor things. It's things that seem very minor. And then we tell ourselves, well, I'm a serious adult. How could I be hurt by the fact that, you know, he or she forgot to, I don't know, ask how my day was, or hasn't, you know, checked my toenail for a bruise or something? You know, we think, oh, I'm beyond all that. But of course, we're not when it comes to love. We're big and brave people in the outside world. But in love, we're, you know, we've got the defenselessness of children. And yet we don't face up to that. And therefore, we get you know, defensive and cold and avoidant around our emotions, which we can't convey to the other person. So that's just, you know, it's one example of, you know, the curriculum we should all have if we sat down and took a course in love.
Well, and I also think a lot about how the language and vocabulary we have around this is so impoverishing, and it actually points us in the wrong direction. I mean, especially the language of falling. Right? I mean, that is always the word we use, falling in love, falling out of love. There's no intentionality. There's no agency in that. I mean, I think a lot about how the Greeks, you know, had different words. We also collapse all of it into these four letters in English, and they're, you know, but in other languages, there's eros, there's agape, there's philia, there's metta in Pali. I also like how you say there's one word, but there are two aspects of it, and these are being loved, which is often what we talk about, what we really mean when we say what we're looking for, right?
That's
right. And then there's loving.
That's right. And the crucial difference is mass between them, and one's a lot tougher than the other. Mm-hmm. And generally, we're much keener on being loved than an extending love. But you know, it's interesting what you're saying about falling in love, because you're absolutely right that we've got this notion that it's a sort of mysterious state. We don't understand why. So there's the idea of, you know, I walked into the bar, there they were, I fell in love. It was a lightning bolt. And again, you know, let's listen to what we've learned over the last few decades, longer than that, let's say the last 100 years, we've really started to understand that, and it's such a basic, you know, it's psychology 101, but one of the most basic insights is the way that we love as adults is very shaped by the way we learnt to love as children. And that whereas we tell ourselves that what we seek in love is happiness, really what we seek in our relationships very often is familiarity, a sense of recreating a tone of love that we knew as children. And unfortunately for almost all of us, the kind of love that we knew as children was not pure, was not purely focused on happiness and contentment. It contained within it some, you know, pretty interesting and at times pretty damaged dynamics, which very often we seek again to recreate in the loves of adulthood. So you'll often get people who, you know, meet each other and then they'll say something like, well, they're really, you know, he was a really nice guy. She was wonderful. But unfortunately, I don't know, it just didn't feel right. I didn't really, you know, they weren't that exciting. And really what we're saying is, probably our unconscious is saying, I didn't sense that they were messed up enough, that they were trouble enough to appeal to the sides of my character that need love to come connected up with certain forms of suffering. I didn't think that they were going to make me suffer in the ways I need to suffer in order to feel that love is real. Now, this sounds pretty strange and pretty challenging, but all of us, I think, do carry within us a sort of, we're not free to love just anyone. We have love maps, you know, and not everybody is on the terrain. So, and I think this is one of the most interesting things about love. And we say things like, well, I like them tall, or they need to have green eyes, or I like them when they're a musician or something. But dig beneath that, it's the psychology of our partners that are so fascinating, you know, our criteria. And often those criteria require difficulty. We don't feel it's real until and unless we feel a certain kind of resistance to some of our more consciously determined goals in love.
Right, because unfortunately, most of that is happening at the unconscious level as well.
That's right. And we don't begin to understand our own pathway to love. How did we come to love? We all know people who will keep falling in love with really arduous characters. You think, this person, you know, she's so beautiful, she's so intelligent, he's so nice, he's so this, and, you know, why are they always going for this sort of situation? And we think it's mysterious, and the truth is, it's not. It's just a little bit complicated, and it involves understanding the evolution of love in somebody's personality. But again, you say that to people and they say, well, that sounds terribly unromantic. Well, good, because the romantic is the enemy of love.
Right. But that's the cardinal rule, the breaking the rule of the way
that's
we
right.
do
if it. If it sounds unromantic, you're probably on the right track, is my rule.
Okay, that's good. I want to read this definition of marriage that you've written in a few places. I think it's wonderful. And just talk about this. Marriage ends up as a hopeful, generous, infinitely kind gamble taken by two people who don't know yet who they are or who the other might be, binding themselves to a future they cannot conceive of and have carefully avoided investigating.
Well, yes, it's challenging, and it's certainly contrary to the romantic view. But again, this kind of realism or acceptance of complexity, I think, is ultimately the friend of love. I'm not, sometimes people say to me, is it just all about reducing our expectations and love isn't nice at all? And I say, no, it's more trying to find our way to our expectations. Our expectations are not wrong. Our assumption of how we're going to get and reach our expectations are fatally flawed. We don't think we're going to have to do any work in order to get there. And that's wrong. I mean, look, it's also worth adding, I don't believe that everybody should stay in exactly the relationship that they're in, and that any relationship is worth sticking with, and that in a way the fault is always the fault of the lovers if it's not, both lovers if it's not happy. There are legitimate reasons to leave a relationship. And I think the moment to leave a relationship is when you can really, if you ask yourself, where are the problems in my love and my life coming from? And if you can sincerely, hand on heart, point to the partner and go, it's really them, the things that are difficult are really them, then you should definitely leave. But if, when you're really being honest, if you ask yourself, why am I in pain? And you can't necessarily attribute all the sorrows that you're feeling to your lover, if you recognize that some of those things are perhaps endemic to existence or endemic to all human beings or something within yourself, then what you're doing is encountering the pain of life with another person, but not necessarily because of another person. And therefore, probably on balance, you might stay because you'll only encounter those same problems elsewhere after a lot of turmoil, angst, and probably cost. So that'd be the way I would separate the staying or the leaving of it.
Yeah. There's also this very poignant thing about us, this that you point out, that it's related to what you said a minute ago, that we kind of we are unconsciously looking for what feels familiar from our childhood. And the fact that and this, I think that you stated this pointedly in the New York Times piece, why you will marry the wrong person, which got set. We'll talk about that. Had such a huge readership. But we marry the wrong people because we don't associate being loved with feeling happy, which flies in the face of all the ideas we have, right? That it's this huge chasm between what we believe and how we actually function, and it's so sad. It's a sad thing about. That many of us don't associate being loved with feeling happy.
Or rather, you know, we associate it with partial sorts of, happiness. But also we want, you know, we're drawn to certain sorts of trouble because that's how we first encountered love. And, you know, childhood is a long time and we're very defenseless in childhood in front of the people who are around us. And so these things dig deep into our personalities. We're heavily imprinted. But I think, you know, I don't think that most of us ever really change our types, but what we can do is change the way we respond to the difficulties that our types create for us. Because often our types, we've learned to respond to our types in ways that we learned in childhood, and therefore they bear the imprint of an original immaturity, so that if somebody, you know, is a little bit distant with us, our response is to sulk and withdraw, let's say. Whereas actually, you know, an adult response might be to say, look, I'm hurt, and explain and account for it and, you know, have a communication around it. So we can learn, or, you know, an early response to a lover that we think is too flawed is to be quite humiliating towards them and attack them and be quite cruel. Whereas actually we might learn the art of couching our criticism in, you know, in gentler ways. So I think that there is a capacity. We all have a capacity to evolve. I don't think we can be radically rewired, but we can come to see that many of the ways in which we respond in love were formed in early childhood, before we really had a sense of what on earth was going on. And we're still continuing to use those first quite basic responses, you know, retreat, attack, violent attack, sulking retreat, etc. We still do that within the context of adult life, even though we're mature in lots of other areas. We're still kind of fighting the battles with the tools of childhood.
Right.
And one of the things we can do, I think, is just evolve those tools. You know, respond differently. You'll still feel hurt, but maybe you can respond to that hurt in a slightly more adult way. You'll still, you know, get angry, but is there a way of channeling the anger in a more adult way? Because, you know, you're a big guy now, so you can do it in a different way. And I think giving ourselves the credit that we can learn new techniques to deal with the feelings that we used to deal with in such an immature, such a childlike way.
And because we have that power, in fact, I mean, that, you know, you say that that is why you conclude that the good news is it doesn't matter if we find we've married the wrong person. That, in fact, is not the greatest task. Or the most rewarding possible task.
You know, so the New York Times asked me to write this this article about marriage. So I ended up writing this piece, which I titled "Why You Will Marry the Wrong Person." And what I meant by that is that the person you'll marry will not be Mr. or Mrs. Right, as defined by romantic culture, and that the idea of rightness is in fact the error, and that when you marry the wrong person, what you're really doing is marrying a human being. And that's fine, because that's all we are as well. And that's not a problem. So in fact, the wrong person's okay. And in fact, it's the right person who's the trouble one. The vision of the right person is the one that gives us so much grief and sets us off on all sorts of, you know, chimerical journeys that lead nowhere.
And you know, I think you know, you're making this argument that, especially for Americans who like things to be clear, and
if I can intrude, I think, yes, bless your lovely country. I think you like things not so much to be clear, well, that as well, but also to be hopeful. I agree with. I'm an American in this respect too, but I think that true hope has to be grounded
on pessimism, on reality-based
pessimism. So I call myself a cheerful pessimist. You know, I think that there's sentimental optimism, which ultimately leads to cynicism and despair. The flip side of sentimental optimism is cynicism and despair.
Yeah. Well, no. But for example, I mean, you are in fact arguing, as you said before, some marriages are meant to end, and there's certainly reasons for marriages to end, or to end marriages. But you also point out this very contradictory fact that the thing that's ultimately wrong with adultery as an easy out to what's going wrong in the marriage is that it is based on the same idealism that certain ideas of marriage are based on that go wrong.
That's right, in a way, that you're just redirecting your hope elsewhere.
Imagine, you know, this is the perfect one, right? This is the one person who won't, with whom you won't be ever be lonely again, who will understand you completely.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. And so it's you know, on and on the cycles of hurt continue. So we should be careful.
Hmm. You know, something that's something else you name about marriage that I feel is not often enough just named is that, you know, we spoke a little while ago about children coming into a marriage, and of course children teach us so much. I mean, one thing you say that's beautiful, the children teach us that love in its purest form is a kind of service. The love we have for our children, I mean, I certainly know this with myself, the love that I have for my children has changed me, and it is distinct from all the other loves I've ever known. But also that the children are hard on marriages, right? And on a more complicated level, if there are problems in the marriage, that can get amplified when children are there. It's also partly just because everybody's tired, right?
That's right. You know, it's interesting. I mean, in a way, there's a lot of mundanity in relationships. And one of the things that romanticism does is to teach us that, you know, the great love stories should be above the mundane. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in none of the great, say, 19th century novels about love, does anyone ever do the laundry? Does anyone ever pick up the crumbs from the kitchen table? Does anyone ever, you know, clean the bathroom? It just doesn't happen because it's assumed that what makes or breaks love are just feelings, passionate emotions, not the kind of day-to-day wear and tear. And yet, of course, when we find ourselves in relationships, it is precisely over these areas that conflicts arise, but we refuse to lend them the necessary prestige. I mean, let's remember that we get angry and frustrated not only when things are difficult, or not principally when things are just difficult. We get angry and frustrated when they're difficult and we don't believe that their difficulty is legitimate, or we haven't prepared for the difficulty. Mm. And so therefore, you know, I mean, there's no arguments as vicious as when two people are arguing about something, but both of them think the argument is trivial. So they'll say things like, well, I mean, it's just, you know, it's absurd. We're arguing over, you know, who should hang up the towels in the bathroom. That's for stupid people.
That has nothing to do with.
And you know that that's going to be trouble because they have no respect for the argument they're having. They have no respect for the things that are making their life difficult, this couple. And so we need, in a way, one of the sort of, you know, one of the lessons of love is to lend a bit of prestige to those issues that crop up in love, like, you know, who does the laundry and on what day. We rush over these decisions and then get very bad-tempered about them because we don't see them as part of the... We don't see them as legitimate. We think it's fine to... But they are. I mean, as you say, there's a lot of life that
is the stuff of life, right? Mundane. Right. It's the stuff of our days. I mean, you know, we also talked a minute ago about how we, you know, parents... work very, they're very, you know, kind of instinctively, intuitively generous with their children in terms of being, you know, say, constantly trying to interpret with maximal generosity what's going on beneath an often difficult surface. But you don't necessarily apply that same generosity to your partner, right? And so, I mean, there's this wonderful line from The Course of Love, about, you know, these two parents with children, the tired child inside each of them is furious at how long it has been neglected and in pieces.
That's right. And, you know, in a way, it's so funny. My wife, I can be indiscreet on air. My wife's used to say to me in the early days of our marriage, she sometimes would say to me things like, you know, my father would never have said something like that. I would say something, or, you know, so I'm, you know, it's not my turn to make the tea or something. She'll go, my father would never have said it. He would always do this for us. And then I had to point out that there was really she wasn't comparing like with like, that she was comparing this man, her father, as a father, but not as a lover. And, you know, in the end, what I wanted to say to her, did end up saying to her, was, in a way, I'm probably behaving exactly like your father, but just not the father that you saw when he was around you. Because one of the things we do as parents...
The way he behaved towards your mother.
That's right. That's right. Exactly. And so one of the things we do as parents is to edit ourselves, which is lovely in a way for our children, but it gives our children a really unnatural sense of what you can expect from another human being, because mm-hmm. we're never as nice to probably anyone else on earth as we are to our children. So we raise right. these people. They understand love from the example that we've set. They then go out into the world and find that, lo and behold, men and women that they meet really are quite different from the template of love that they've seen. You know, oddly, the person that they're loving is quite tired. And when they're tired, they get a bit grumpy and they don't speak. And you've tried to, you know, ask them right, to cook dinner right, and they didn't. Right. And none of this they've experienced with their parents, maybe. Right. I mean, I'm saying this is the cost of good parenting.
Such a good point. Yes, yes. You know, I'd like to go a slightly different place with all of this. You know, I've been... The things you've been saying, pointing out about how love really works, that humiliating somebody doesn't actually, that people don't learn when they're humiliated, that self-righteousness is an enemy of love. I'm thinking a lot right now these days about how and if we could apply the intelligence we actually have with the experience of love, not the ideal, but the experience of love in our lives, to how we, can be as citizens moving forward, where there's a lot of behavior in public. I'm speaking for the United States, but I think there are forms of this in the UK as well. We're kind of acting out in public the way we act out at our worst in relationships.
I think that's fascinating. I think you're onto something huge and rather counterintuitive, because we associate mm-hmm. the word love with private life. Mm-hmm. We don't associate it with life in the republic, with civil society.
Yes.
But I think that a functioning society requires two things that, don't sound very normal, but they require love and politeness. And, yes. and these sound like very odd virtues to be advocating for the citizen. And we don't really, you know, have them at the forefront of our kind of ideas about how to live as a citizen. But I think they're absolutely key. By love, I mean a capacity to enter imaginatively into the minds of people with whom you don't immediately agree. Mm. And to look for the more charitable explanations for behavior which doesn't appeal to you and which could seem plain wrong, not just to chuck them immediately in prison or to haul them up in front of a law court, but to also...
Or just tell them how stupid they are, right? Just...
Right, or tell... Exactly, because we're permanently, you know, all sides are attempting to show how stupid every other side
right.
is. And the other thing, of course, is politeness, which is an attempt not necessarily to say everything, to understand that there is a role for private feelings, which, if they were to emerge, would do damage to everyone concerned, and therefore mm-hmm. they should be withheld. We, again, live in this romantic culture where if you feel something, you must express it. If you hate someone, you must tell them immediately.
Right.
If you're angry, off you go. It's bad to bottle up feelings. Well, you know, I don't know. And both in private life and political life, you know, we've got this idea, if we just look at relationships for a second, we've got this idea that keeping a secret is a very bad thing. And that, you know, true lovers tell each other everything. Well, again, I think that sometimes to be wholly yourself in the presence of another is a pretty mean thing to be. It's a treat you should reserve, you know, not for anyone that you really care about. Because, you know, who we are, unvarnished, without any, filters, is very challenging and not something that we should, you know, routinely parade.
We've
got this culture of kind of self-disclosure. And as I say, it spills out into politics as well. The same dynamic goes on. Of like, if I'm not telling you exactly what I think, then, you know, I may develop a twitch or an illness from not,
right.
you know, expunging my feelings. And you know, to which I would say, no, you're not. You're preserving, you know, the peace and, good nature of the republic. And it's absolutely what you should be doing.
Yes. And I guess, you know, I've been having this conversation with a lot of people this year. I mean, there's a lot of the truth is, more than ever before, perhaps, in our world, we are in relationship. Right. We are connected to everyone else. And that's a fact. Their well-being will impact our well-being, is of relevance to our well-being and that of our children But there's we have this habit and this capacity in public to. And it also, we know this, we know that our brains work this way, right? To see the other, to see those strangers, those people on the other side, politically, socioeconomically, whatever. Forgetting that in our intimate lives, in our love lives, you know, in our circles of family and friends, and in our marriages and with our children, there are things about the people we love the most who drive us crazy that we do not comprehend, and yet we find ways to be intelligent, right? To be loving, because it gets a better result.
That's right. And you know, families are at this kind of testbed of love because, well, we can't entirely quit them. And this is what makes families so fascinating, because you're thrown together with a group of people who you would never pick if you could simply pick on the grounds of, you know, compatibility. And you're forced to seek compatibility. And I think, you know, we're so obsessed by always finding the perfectly compatible person. The really compatible person for us is not someone who agrees with everything that we say and think. It's someone who knows how intelligently to disagree. You know, compatibility is an achievement of love. It shouldn't be the precondition of love, as we nowadays, in a slightly spoiled way, imagine it must be.
Yes, nine to ten a.m. on Sunday and eight to nine p.m. on Tuesday here on Troy Public Radio. Nine to ten a.m. on Sunday and eight to nine p.m. on Tuesday here on Troy Public Radio.
You know, here outside on Troy Public of private Radio. Space, and you know, the media you take in, the films you see, you know, the way the news is read, etc. All these things are political phenomena. And we're highly socialized creatures who really take our cues from what is going on around us. And if we see an atmosphere of short tempers, of selfishness, etc., you know, that will bolster those capacities within ourselves. If we see charity being exercised, if we see good humor, if we see forgiveness on display, again, it will lend support to those sides of ourselves. And you know, we need to take care what we're exposing ourselves to, because too much exposure to, you know, the opposite of love, you know, makes us into very hostile and angry people.
Yes, and I think it's also such an important thing to bear in mind, that the import of our conduct moment to moment, that is having effects that we can't see.
That's right. I mean, you know, we were talking a minute ago about how very often you notice in relationships, because people are honest about it in relationships, they really don't dare in other areas. But, you know, sometimes one of the things that's fascinating in a relationship is how people will have an argument about or get hurt. Sorry, let me start again. One of the things that's fascinating about relationships is that people will reveal that they've been hurt by incredibly minor things. Mm-hmm. They'll say things like, you know, why are you angry with me? Well, you know, when you left to go to work, I said, have a nice day. And you went, rather than thanks, you know, and I've been angry all day. And actually, I don't really want to speak to you because of that word you said. And in a way, it sounds ridiculous. But actually, we humans are like this. We're far more sensitive than we allow for. Mm-hmm. And we need to build a world that recognizes that if somebody goes, you know, rather than this, or thanks rather than yes, or, you know, whatever it is, this can ruin our day. And we should think about that as we approach not just our personal relationships, but also our social and political relationships. These things are humiliating. Little things can deeply wound and humiliate.
And also that big things like, right, that, you know, this has been throughout our conversation, that the hurts that we carry forward in life, the pain we feel, which often then feels like anger, coexists with anger, you know, that what comes out on the surface may look very different, but these are the things that drive bad, what looks like bad behavior or what looks like puzzling behavior. And that's as true in public life as it is in private life as well.
You know, in a way, one of the things we need is a kind of emotional translation tool, because what people say to us is often so much at variance with what they mean. So, you know, you know, classic one is when somebody goes, oh, I don't really want to see you. You know, I'm a bit bored of you. Often what they might really mean is, Loving you has become too painful for me. You've hurt me in ways that I don't know how to deal with. I feel so vulnerable. My only recourse is to run away. This is what psychologists would describe as avoidant behavior. But then there's another kind that gets described as anxious behavior, where someone will go something like, I hate you. You always leave everything in a mess. Why can't you just pull yourself together? Which might really mean, I feel you're pulling away from me. I want to get close, but I don't know how. And so it's terribly poignant that sometimes our most horrible statements don't actually mean what we think they mean, what we might suppose they mean. They actually are just the legacies of a desire for tenderness and support that has become incredibly conflicted and hard to admit to, because it makes us look so weak in front of people. You know, let's not forget that one of the things that makes relationships so scary is we need to be weak in front of other people. And most of us are just experts at being pretty strong. You know, we've been doing it for years. We know how to be strong. What we don't know how to do is to make ourselves safely vulnerable. And so we tend to get very twitchy, preternaturally aggressive, etc., when we're asked to, when the moment has come to be weak.
Yeah. And I mean, again, I feel like I'm overstating this point, but that has its corollaries in public life as well. And, I feel like there's almost this calling now, because the stakes are so high, for emotional intelligence in public, which of course none of us gets perfectly in our intimate lives, but we do know these things about people we love, and they're also true of people we don't know and don't think we love.
I mean, many of the great lessons we sort of know. There's that wonderful term the ancient Greeks had, akrasia, which gets translated as weakness of the will, which is really this phenomena that the Greek philosophers discovered, which is when you know what is right, you're committed to doing what is right, but at a key moment you don't do it because the will is weak. And their solution to this, I'm picking this up from Aristotle, their solution to it is, broadly speaking, art. That the phenomenon we would nowadays recognize as art or culture, the surrounding culture, has to support our will. It has to constantly keep alive the kind of freshness and relevance of ideas, which we assent to in theory, but forget about in practice. And this is, the help of culture, the work of culture.
Well, oh, sorry, there's something behind the glass. Okay. Okay. All right. Okay. All right. Yeah, we'll do. So we're going to, we have about 20 more minutes, but I want to return a little bit to love and sex and Eros and all of this. I have to say, one thing I really love and appreciate and learned from in your writing is your reflection on flirting as an art, the art of flirting, that it can be something edifying, a pleasurable gift, and that we kind of have internalized these very old kind of Puritan ideas that anything like that would be an immediate threat to a relationship, and that that's just not true. And you have this phrase, a good flirt. So would you describe what a good flirt is?
Well, if we think about what flirtation is, in many ways, flirtation is the attempt to awaken somebody else to their attractiveness. Mm-hmm. And it's often taken to mean that that has to be followed by sexual contact, or else it's not real, or else it's a deception. But it isn't. I mean, I think, it would be such a pity if we had to drive something as important as kind of validation and self-acceptance and a pleasant view of oneself through the gate of, rather narrow gate of sex. It doesn't have to go through that gate. It is possible to flirt, to reawaken someone to their value in ways which don't involve actual sexual contact. And flirtation is a kind of act of the imagination. And, you know, what's fun about flirtation is that it often happens between really quite unlikely people. You know, two people meet and, you know, maybe they're both with someone or there's a, you know, difference in status or background, etc. And they can find that they're in a little conversation about the weather or whatever, and both parties will recognize there's something a little bit flirtatious going on. Mm-hmm. And it's got really nothing to do with sex as such. It's just two people delighting in awakening one another to the fact that they're quite nice people and they're quite attractive and that's okay. But, you know, we too often want things to be cut and dry, which is a pity.
Yeah. I mean, I think you also have this one lovely film. It's one of these School of Life films about this. You know, here's you know, a good flirt. You can make these assumptions that this other person, you know, maybe would love to sleep with us, won't sleep with us. And the reason why they won't has nothing to do with any deficiency on our part. But it's also not, as you say, a deception. It's a natural, pleasurable human experience.
That's right. I mean, the other thing... Sorry, I don't know if I can speak out of turn or it just comes to mind. But the other thing that I feel, you know, that we get quite wrong in our culture is the whole business of what sex actually is. Mm-hmm. You know, because we've come kind of from a Freudian world. You know, Freud has told us that there's a lot more going on in sex than we want to believe, and that a lot of it is quite weird and darker than we'd ever want to imagine. And that sex is everywhere in life, even in places where we don't think it is or perhaps should be. But in a way, I've got a sort of different view of this. I think that it's not so much that sex is everywhere, it's that psychological dynamics are everywhere, even in sex. And so often we think of sex as just a sort of pneumatic activity, but really it's a psychological activity. And if you try to imagine why people are excited by sex, it's not so much that it's a pleasurable, nerve-ending business. It's ultimately that it's about acceptance. If you think about why, you know, why is it exciting to kiss someone for the first time? It's not, you know, it's probably more fun eating an oyster or flossing your teeth or watching TV than kissing. I mean, it's a bit weird. And what's this odd thing we call kissing? It's like sort of trying to inflate somebody else's mouth. I mean, it's just odd. Nevertheless, we like it. Not because of its physical feeling, but because of what it means, the meaning we infuse. And the meaning we infuse into it is, I accept you. And I accept you in a way that is incredibly intimate and that would be quite revolting with anyone else. I'm allowing you into my private space as a way of signaling, I like you. And what really, we call it getting turned on, but what we really are, as it were, excited by is that someone accepts us with remarkable, you know, in all
takes
our...
takes delight in us.
Right, takes delight in us. And that's what's exciting about it. And you can look at all sorts of sexual practices as basically the reason why they're exciting is because they are, in their varied ways, forms of radical acceptance of one person by another, which doesn't exist in other areas. So, in other words, sex is continuous with a lot of things that we're interested in outside of the bedroom. And I think we've slightly compartmentalized it as a sort of a bizarre activity where we lose our minds and forget that we care about anything that we'd care anywhere else. It's not true. As I say, the sexual impulse is in many ways continuous.
Yeah, and you say that flirting, you know, is one way to experience in the course of ordinary life in a way that's completely non-threatening to whatever your commitments are. What is enjoyable about sex? It's not necessarily the act itself. The fact that we are sexual beings.
That's right. Mm. That's right. And you know, but we feel often conflicted about it. I shouldn't be flirting. I can't flirt, etc. So there's a lot of fear of there's a lot of fear of slippery slopes. You know, in many situations we can hang on the slippery slope. It's okay. We've got tools to hang on in there.
Yeah. I want to know, I don't want to let you go before asking what you think about, what's your view of online dating? Because this is a new way that so many people, perhaps most people, moving forward are meeting, are engaging this romantic side of themselves.
Look, I mean, at one level, online dating promises to open up something absolutely wonderful, which is a more logical way of getting together with someone. The sort of dream is that the secrets of our soul and the secrets of somebody else's soul will be sort of downloaded onto a computer, and that we will find the best possible match for who we are. Because the old way, which is that you might bump into somebody at a bar or at a party, is obviously flawed from lots of ways. So in other words, there's something very nice, rational, and you know, you have to approve of it. The darker side of online dating is that it encourages the idea that a good relationship must mean a conflict-free relationship, and therefore any relationship which has conflict in it, which has unhappiness and areas of tension in it, is wrong and can be terminated because we have this wonderful backup, which is alternatives. We can start swiping through some other people quite soon. And so therefore, it makes us impatient. And impatience can be a real enemy of long-term relationships. So like any tool, it's got its pluses and minuses and has to be used correctly. And I think what I mean by correctly is it has to broaden the pool of people from which we're choosing our lovers while not giving us the illusion that there is such a thing as a perfect human being.
Right. So then you're back to the basic truth, the darker truth about love. Also that what online dating does, it is introduces you to people, but then is really the whole thrust of your thinking is it's that loving is really what comes next, right? It's what
that's
comes
right.
after
and, you know,
the meeting.
That's right. Silicon Valley has been incredibly interested in getting us to that first stage of meeting the person. And, you know, that's great. But the next stage has been abandoned. You know, where is the app that will tell you how to read, you know, how to interpret somebody else's confused signals of distress, or that will remind you at a certain point to, you know, look charitably upon, you know, someone's behavior because you remember their childhood, etc. So we have a long way to go. Our technology is still, look, we're still, it sounds odd because it's one of the sort of narcissisms of our time that we think we're living late on in the history of the world. And we think we're sort of, you know, we're latecomers to the party. Right. We're still at the very beginning of understanding ourselves as, you know, human emotional creatures. We're still, you know, taking our first baby steps in the understanding of love. And we need a lot of compassion for ourselves. And no wonder we make horrific mistakes, you know, pretty much all the time. We're not collecting our knowledge in the way it should be collected. We're not transmitting that knowledge in the way that other disciplines like, you know, bioengineering collect their knowledge. There's no system of knowledge transfer when it comes to relationships. And there's very little public awareness of and cultural awareness of the challenges of love. So, you know, of course, the norm is we're going to get this wrong. You know, substantially wrong, not just inevitably, you know, a little bit wrong, but you know, properly and avoidably wrong. As I say, yeah, I think a certain compassion, as well as, you know, more political in the broad sense, engagement with some of the issues that are responsible for kind of shielding us from accessing the knowledge that is out there about how to run a relationship, how to love. We need an education in love, and we need to be kind enough to ourselves to know how to find it, realize we need it, and get it for ourselves.
I think a lot about the fact that we support other people we love, our family and friends, in being present at the vows, right? Again, at that very beginning, we're there. We celebrate that beginning. I suspect that in days when there were extended families, but, you know, I may be romanticizing the idea of extended families, marriages were held by a larger network of relationships. I don't know if that's true. I'm sure some of those networks were dysfunctional. I wonder, I love what you just said about we need to take this more seriously and become educated about love. I wonder if there's a role. I mean, you're at an age now, I think, where a lot of people are getting divorces, right? In your 40s, probably.
Sure.
A lot of people, you know. I wonder what our role is to be with each other's marriages or with each other's long-term love. And I think we have no training in that or no instincts in that.
that's a fascinating idea because, you know, very much the spirit of our times, and it's been going for a long while, is to try and say that marriage is unnecessary and that, you know, the whole thing is so difficult, so costly. What's the point of this? Who needs it? It makes love more difficult. You know, if one wanted to play devil's advocate and defend marriage, and, you know, I don't want to get into the culture wars. I don't think it's got anything to do with that. But if you wanted to mount a kind of philosophical defense of marriage, its difficulty is not incidental. The fact that once you marry, when you marry, you invite, you know, 100 of your friends and they give you expensive, quite expensive presents that they've really had to spend a lot of money on and a lot of, you know, it's all generating massive embarrassment for the moment that you'd call up and go, you know, despite the television and the microwave, we're splitting up, you know. The point is, you know, and your aunt, she flew halfway around the world, she bought an expensive airline ticket, etc. You need that elderly aunt because it's going to be terribly embarrassing to call her up and go, despite the coffee maker that you bought and the trip you took from San Francisco, we're quitting. And I think that that embarrassment can, and also, again, we need to be careful here, but can be an important conduit to reserves of patience, of imagination, of intelligence that we can bring to bear on a relationship before we simply blow it up. Yeah. And therefore, it's not a coincidence that it can be quite hard to get out of marriages. There's a role, you know, marriage is in a way a willing shackling of two people to one another. You throw away the key and you cage yourself. You willingly do this. Why? Because you're aware that certain forms of maturity, certain forms of growth are only available to you if you can't run away the first moment when things get difficult. And I think that, you know, I hope I'm not speaking just purely autobiographically. You'll tell me, or your listeners will tell me. But, you know, most marriages, even quite good ones, probably have at least one time a week when one's just dying to run away and, you know, can't imagine why one's ever ended up in this situation. But, you know, just as important as that feeling is, the other feeling that's important is the thought of, oh my God, well, how would I set about unchaining myself? And the fact it's quite hard gives a more mature and more emotionally resilient part of the mind time to organize itself and think, okay, is there another way? Might we do something? And that's how we grow, you know. That's how we keep making an effort. If it were too easy, well, you know, we might not.
I happened to see your tweet at the end of 2016 when the New York Times released its most read articles of the year. And your "Why You Will Marry the Wrong Person" was number one, which is really extraordinary. I mean, what, you know, the most read article in a year of the Brexit vote, the presidential election, war, refugee crisis. I wonder what that tells you about us as a species.
It was deeply fascinating and quite extraordinary. And apparently it was first by a long way. I mean, it's just peculiar.
Yes.
And I think that, first of all, it tells us that we have an enormous loneliness around our difficulties. You know, one could write a follow-on piece, I may or may not, you know, called "Why You Will Get Into the Wrong Job," which would probably score quite highly too. And, you know, "Why You'll Have the Wrong Child," and "Why You'll Go on the Wrong Vacation," and "Why Your Body Will Be the Wrong Shape," and "Why You'll Think You Live in the Wrong Country," etc. And, you know, in a way, we need solace for the sense that we have gone wrong in an area, whatever it may be, that where perfection was possible. And anyone who comes along and says, you know, it's normal that you are suffering, life is suffering, is doing a quite unusual thing in our culture, which is so much about optimism. You know, let's remember that Buddhism starts with the idea, literally the statement, life is suffering. You know, Judaism and Christianity both have as a bedrock the idea that man is imperfect, a sinner, is broken, right? You know, strip away the theology from it. Really what it's saying is, you know, we're imperfect beings. And that is, it sounds grim. It is, in fact, enormously consoling and alleviating and helpful in a culture which is oppressive in its demands for perfection. So, you know, I think a certain kind of pessimistic realism, which is totally compatible with hope, totally compatible with laughter, good humor, a sense of fun. It's not. It doesn't have to be dour.
No, comedy and tragedy belong together. Yeah.
Exactly. So, you know, I'm a great fan of gallows humor. I mean, we're all on the way to the gallows in one way or another, and you know, we can hug and give each other laughs and point out the more pleasant sides as we head towards the scaffold.
That may be your last word. I just want to ask you, we began to speak about On Love, which you wrote, I think, which was published when you were 23 in the late 90s. You've now been married for over a dozen years. And, you know, what did you really not know? I mean, and that book was so wise. And in fact, that book that you published when you were 23, On Love, really presented a lot of the themes you've carried forward in time. But I do wonder, like, what you really did not know, what you've learned, what you continue to learn about love at this stage in your life.
That's such a good question. And it'll make the 23-year-old me sound more stupid than he was. Mm. But I genuinely thought at that time that if I, and people in general, met the right person, there would be no problem. That problems in love are the result of being with people who are, in one way or another, defective. Mm. And, you know, in 2002, this belief was severely tested in that I met someone who was really absolutely wonderful in every way. And through much effort, I pursued her and eventually married her and discovered something very surprising. She was great in a million ways. She was very right. And yet, oddly, there were all sorts of problems. And I think it's been, you know, the path that I've been on to realize that those problems had nothing to do with her being a deficient person, or indeed with me being a horribly deficient person. They were to do with the challenges of being a human being trying to relate to another human being in a loving relationship, that I was encountering some endemic issues that every couple, however well matched, and there is no such thing as a perfect match, but however well matched, every couple will encounter these problems. And it made me develop a new ideology of love, which, you know, what separates the course On Love, my first book, from The Course of Love, my latest book, apart from the big time span, is a new idea that love is something we have to learn and we can make progress with, and that it's not just an enthusiasm, it's a skill, and it requires forbearance, generosity, imagination, and a million things besides. And we must fiercely resist the idea that true love must mean conflict-free love, that the course of true love is smooth. It's not. The course of true love is rocky and bumpy at the best of times. That's the best we can manage as the creatures we are. It's nothing, no fault of mine or no fault of yours. It's to do with being human. And the more generous we can be towards that flawed humanity, the better chance we'll have of doing the true hard work of love.
Hmm. Well, what I know is it's going to be really hard to edit this. It's been completely delightful. It's such an important subject. And I'm thrilled to speak with you again. And I'm going to be so happy to put this on the air.
Well, it's always a thrill for me, and I love what you do. I love what your team does, and you're a giant force for good in the world, in a troubled world. Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure for me.
Yeah, good. All right, wonderful.
Okay, thank you. Thank you so much.
We'll send you all the details about when this is going up.
Oh, that would be great, and I'll push it along as well.
We'd love for you to do that. Okay, all right, bye-bye. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye from London. Bye-bye.
Bye.